So I offered to do today, well, I kind of demanded to do today, and then I find myself sitting in front of a screen, asking why I didn't leave it well alone. Firstly, because I didn't have the benefit of Sermon Circle, our wonderful online in-person discussion on a Wednesday morning, where they normally throw way more material than I can manage. And we didn't have it because we were on a post-Christmas break. And secondly, looking back through my notes, I have preached an awful lot on Epiphany. And I was wondering if I might have run out of material. You've heard my thoughts on these very readings that we heard today 10 times in the last 13 years. Or last 13 Epiphany Sundays. Though you may be interested to know that in the years since I arrived, my sermons have actually got shorter. They just feel longer. Anyway, having seen how many times that I have preached on this feast, I did wonder about how different I could make this sermon, or even if I needed to. I was tempted to reuse an old sermon and see if anyone spots it. But my experience of this congregation, horror of horrors, is that you do remember my sermons and even feed stuff back to me in months and years ahead. So I didn't want to try any direct recycling. I got my inspiration instead from the Saturday Night Live Christmas special, where they gather bits from the years and they put them together. And hopefully that what I'm doing today is reminding us of some things that perhaps at this time we need to be reminded of at this Epiphany. I want to begin by repeating something that I don't think I can say often enough. When we open our scriptures, we must remember how carefully these stories, these histories, I say in quotes, how these documents have been constructed, and how much more there is, and often how much less there is in the stories that we hear than we assume. Because our telling of all of the Christmas story, including this festival of Epiphany, is mixed up with assumptions and interpretations and misinterpretations that are built up over the centuries. Like Mary riding a donkey to Bethlehem. There is no mention of any donkey anywhere in any scriptural text, at least not relating to the Christmas story. There's a talking donkey at one point, but that's for another sermon. There's no innkeeper mentioned anywhere, despite the fact I love being the grumpy innkeeper every Christmas Eve when I tell the story of Jesus' first birthday party. There is no innkeeper mentioned anywhere in any of the stories. And there's even good reason to question the use of the word in the story. But that's a really long thing, and there's lots of Greek involved, and I'm not great at Greek, so I'm not going to go into that one. But house, maybe, or guest house, or guest room in a house may be a better translation. And it reminds us that so much of what we think is in our scripture story is actually what has been layered on over the years, which is kind of ironic because of the layers that are already in each story that we have in the scriptures. What we have layered on over the years, for instance, includes the idea that the magi, the mages, the sages, were kings. This was added by some storytellers as an explanation for the generosity of the gifts given to the Christ child, and perhaps as an attempt at explaining how these individuals could leave their homelands and travel to Bethlehem. But it's all speculation, as is the idea that there were three magi. There is no mention of how many in the text. There's just an assumption made because of the three gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And indeed, we don't even know that any of this happened as recorded. It's only Matthew that has this story. And as I've said before, it has layer and layer of symbolism, which points perhaps more clearly to a mythic than a literal telling of a tale. But we don't need this story to be literally true, to be filled with truth. The gifts, as you'll probably know, are all believed to have a symbolic meaning. In fact, we sing about it. If you could, if anyone wants to start We Three Kings at any point, you can probably join in. Frankincense is used in worship And it's used, many would say, to reflect the priestly nature of Jesus. Gold is a symbol of the wealth of kings, or as some interpreters say, the riches of the life of faith. And myrrh symbolizes the suffering and death which Christ is to undergo. Those meanings were given by later interpreters, and there's probably even more to these offerings than those explanations give us. And there's no direct analogy between one thing and another. It's all there as part of the richness and the depth and the metaphor and the poetry within it. We could spend a lot more time going over it, but my epiphany gift to you is I won't. And this, for me, all comes back to the reminder that we need to stop trying to fit everything together with our kind of logic. To see again the symbolic and poetic nature of these stories. There are layers upon layers upon layers of vivid and vital imagery, of truth, of meaning. When we can let go of the need to be quote unquote reasonable, by which I mean that we stop demanding that everything conforms to our own intellectual and rational structures, then we can encounter and be gripped by something of the mystery, the wonder of these stories, these parables, these symbols. There is one part of the symbolism that I think we should definitely carry with us at this time. And indeed, within the broader Christmas story, it's a theme that comes out again and again. There is the repeated uplifting of the outsider, the welcoming of the stranger, the embrace of the outcast. From the young woman chosen to be Theotokos, the bearer of God, to the manual worker that takes her as his partner, to the shepherds excluded from polite society who were welcomed at the manger crib, and now to these astrologers, stargazers from beyond the pale. They are non-Jews. They indulge in reading the stars for signs, which is in turn ridiculed and despised by the Hebrew scriptures, though it seems that a lot of people indulged in it in Judah and beyond. Epiphany is usually described as the manifesting of Christ to the Gentiles, as symbolized by these magi. Yet the story tells us the divine was at work in these wanderers and wanderers long before they turned up at the manger crib. The whole nativity story is about the way in which God works with, within, and through the outsider. The Spirit is present in those places we do not expect her to be. This wonderful, mind-expanding, symbol-stuffed story challenges us to see the divine in those we would seek to ignore and exclude, those we would like to keep out of our safe spaces. It challenges our conceptions of where God is to be found and in whom God chooses to work. As churches, I think we're constantly in danger of turning inward, reduced by our anxieties over money or attendance or our fears of the world outside or the mess we feel the world is in, particularly at this time. We're reduced to haggling over finances, to moving the pews around a bit, or even wanting to swap out the incumbent in a way that's reminiscent of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. As we end this time, this first 12 days of Christmas with this challenging story, let's move instead to an expansive and generous vision of who we are, creating community, committed to justice, to love, and to grace. And let us remember the God who is less concerned about who gets invited in as to who we go out to. For beyond the nativity story are repeated times Jesus goes out into the world around and sends his followers to do the same, to bring healing, to make a difference, to love and to serve, to challenge injustice, to stand against empire and against dominion. In the year ahead, let's commit ourselves to taking the inside out as much as we continue to seek to be a welcoming and inclusive community that brings the outside in. May we be all that God is calling us to be, and may we go where God is calling us to go. Thanks be to God.